You are listening to Mountain Money, broadcasting from KPCW, Park City, Utah.
Good morning and welcome to the January 25th edition of Mountain Money. I'm Roger Goldman. I'm here with my trusty co-host, Allison Kulo. Good morning, Allison.
Good morning.
What a nice weekend for the weather. We had lots of snow, and yesterday, I guess it was Saturday morning, I went to get a cup of coffee, and I saw the line of cars backed up 224 turning right into the resort. I think we had a lot of pent-up demand for a little powder, and I think people were really, really happy to get some.
I'd like to give us credit for the powder, because last Monday you asked if it had any snow in the forecast, and I said no. So I think that's why we were able to get some, so I was excited as well.
Well, clearly we're going to turn from the topic of powder to the topic of power. This morning, David Sandlow, the former Undersecretary for the United States Department of Energy, is going to join us to talk about potential changes in energy policy and their impact on the economy under a Biden administration.
We'll next talk with author Fawn Germer. She's joining us to discuss her new book, Coming Back, How to Win the Job You Want When You've Lost the Job You Need.
And we will end the hour talking with John Courtney, the butcher and co-owner of Chop Shop Park City, which has nothing to do with cutting up cars, but is in fact a new full-service butchery located in the Newport Town Center. All this and more today on Mountain Money. We'll be right back with David Sandlow after this.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. We are working on making sure our first guest can call in. And again, we will be talking with David Sandlow, and you are listening to Mountain Money. We're excited to be able to get kicking off. And I think one of the things that we're going to be looking at in future weeks is to talk about how the winter economy is looking here in Park City. I know that we had a strong holiday season, and this is the week that Sundance would typically be going all week long. With their event starting this weekend, we're not anticipating any visitors coming to the area, but we are hoping for a significant number of skiers to maybe take advantage of the available lodging and now new snow to be able to join us. So we're excited for that and hoping that this winter turns out well. Mountain Money will be right back after this. Welcome back to Mountain Money. Our guest is going to be coming in just a moment, and we are excited to talk to him. As you know, there's been a lot of changes as President Biden has come into the role as of last Wednesday, and quite a bit that he's taking care of with executive orders. So we are, again, anticipating quite a bit of changes going on with the administration and what their policies are, as well as the goals that have been stated.
We're fortunate this morning to be joined by David Sandlow, who is calling in. He is the former acting Undersecretary of Energy and Assistant Secretary for Policy and International Affairs. He is currently the inaugural fellow at the Center on Global Energy Policy and co-director of the Energy and Environment Concentration at Columbia University. David, good morning. Welcome to Mountain Money.
Good morning, Roger. Great to be with you.
Thank you so much for joining us. Okay. One of the things that I wanted to start with talking about were there were a lot of major changes in energy policy under the Trump administration. For example, the decision to withdraw from the Paris Climate Accord, the rollback of regulations under the Clean Air Act, the changing of fuel economy standards for automobiles, and the bans that were lifted on oil and gas exploration in federal lands. Let's talk a little bit about how significant those changes were, and where do you think the Biden administration will see its priorities with respect to changing some of them?
Well, Roger, first, great to be with you and all your viewers and all your listeners. Those changes were very significant. The Trump administration really did a 180-degree reversal on the Obama administration's policies in this area and across a range of areas, including the ones you just mentioned. And the Biden administration is going to do a 180-degree reversal back. I think one of the most significant developments we're seeing from the Biden administration is the priority that climate change is receiving, which is as high as this issue has ever been. President Obama spent time and devoted some effort to the climate change issue, but as did President Clinton before him. But there's never been a time in that the climate change issue has gotten such attention as it's received in the past year. And there's never been an administration that gave it the priority it's receiving. You know, if you went to the Biden administration's transition website, there were four priorities that were identified there: COVID, economic recovery, racial justice, and then climate change. And then you see across the administration, very experienced and committed appointees who are taking jobs related to climate change, and indeed appointees in offices that don't directly address climate change who have deep background in this issue. So I think it's going to be very interesting on the climate issue in particular.
Talk a little bit about, you know, how you expect to see that sort of emphasis translated into policy. For example, I mean, the idea of the role of John Kerry, isn't that something really that we've never seen before?
That's exactly correct. I'll talk about John Kerry, but let me just highlight what I think, the way I think that President Biden would answer this question if you were asking him that. His line during his campaign was, when I think of climate change, I think of one word, jobs. And I think what you're going to see is a determined effort on the part of the Biden administration to create jobs in the clean energy economy and to make clear that sustainable economic growth involves taking on the climate challenge. That's going to mean investments in climate-friendly infrastructure like electric vehicle chargers. It's going to mean creating jobs in things like land conservation, a whole range of different areas. Now, you asked about John Kerry. Yeah, this is a very interesting development, and this is a little kind of inside baseball Washington bureaucracy, but President Biden has appointed John Kerry to be the United States' top climate change negotiator. Now, John Kerry, you know, most people will remember, was Secretary of State. He was the chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. He was the Democratic presidential nominee in 2004. There's never been a top climate change diplomat from the United States with remotely that level of profile. We've had some incredible and talented climate change envoys in the past, but they've been at the kind of undersecretary level in the State Department. Now we have somebody who's a globally famous, you know, globally prominent figure who, when he travels abroad, he meets with heads of state, not kind of ministry officials, running climate change diplomacy. It's another example of the priority that the Biden administration is attaching to this topic.
I know we'll get into some of the details as far as the U.S. and what we're looking at, but I do want to just reemphasize that we have now rejoined the Paris Accord, not the Pittsburgh Accord, but the Paris. And, you know, with John Kerry having more of an international role, what does this mean, and how will this help the United States with our relationships?
Well, let me first, I love your reference to the Pittsburgh Accord. And let me just explain for your listeners who might not know the reference what's behind that. Both about 2 or 3 years ago and then last week, Senator Ted Cruz of Texas tweeted out criticism saying that joining the Paris Agreement only means that, what he said last week was, it means that President Biden cares more about the people of Paris than he does about the people of Pittsburgh. And in response to that, the mayor of Pittsburgh responded both last week and several years ago, saying, we have more clean energy jobs here in Pittsburgh than we have jobs in the old fossil fuel economy. The people of Pittsburgh support, you know, I support the Paris Agreement. And then, of course, many commentators said, the reason that this agreement is called the Paris Agreement isn't because it's about the people of Paris, it's because it was signed there. And, you know, the Geneva Convention, which is, you know, long-standing treaty, isn't about Geneva. It's about, you know, war and peace and related issues. And so that's the reference on Pittsburgh. Now, re-entering the Paris Agreement, I think in many ways one of the main impacts is it will start to restore respect for America around the world. This is an agreement that about 190 nations are members of. I think North Korea may not be a member. I have to double check that. But other than, you know, a few pariah states and then the United States under the Trump administration, there was nobody that wasn't a member. And the agreement reflects the global consensus around the priority that we need to attach to climate change, the fact that it's a threat. And it you know, in many ways, I think most climate change scientists would criticize the agreement as being too weak. It's a, in many ways, a voluntary, in almost every way, a voluntary agreement. It's an agreement in which countries offer up to the world their pledges about what they're going to do on climate change. There's no specific requirements to do anything, but it's a way of sharing information and coming together to work on this global challenge. So the fact the United States is now a member, I think, sends a clear signal that we're part of the fight, that we're in this to help avoid the worst impacts of climate change. And it starts to restore the respect that America lost so profoundly in the past several years around the world.
You know, one of the fatalistic criticisms I heard you heard about the Paris Accord was that it was, you know, what was the point of it if other countries were going to continue to, you know, inject massive carbon into the atmosphere? And I guess that I always thought that the main point of it was you wanted to be part of the team that was actually trying to do something about it, and that by not doing it, you were really not showing any leadership.
That's exactly right, Roger. And in fact, the main point of the Paris Agreement is this needs to be a global solution. The United States is 15% of global emissions right now. We can't do this alone. But every other country in the world has the same, you know, situation. I mean, by the way, the leading emitter in the world is China. But in China, they could say the same thing. They could say, we're only, you know, roughly a quarter of global emissions. We can't do it alone. Why should we do it? So you've got to come together as a globe in order to solve this problem. And that's what the Paris Agreement brings countries together to do.
You know, you talked about the importance from the Biden administration's perspective of jobs. And last week with the announcement that the pipeline from Canada was going to be canceled, there was a lot of reaction in the Twitter sphere about how this was going to cut lots and lots of union jobs. What's the response to that, David? Why was it a good thing to terminate the Keystone Pipeline, and how is it that those jobs that are going to be lost are going to be restored?
Yeah, so this is an issue that has somewhat divided the Democratic caucus, I think, with some labor unions quite opposed to this measure and some environmental activists, you know, many environmental activists in favor of it. This gets down to a core issue of how you approach the issue of climate change. And many environmental activists right now argue that we just need to stop building fossil fuel infrastructure, that once you build pipelines like this one or others, they're around for 40 years. They build up constituencies that support their continued operation. They point to coal plants in the United States, which some coal plants, you know, were built in the 1960s and kept operating for 50 years, well past, you know, what many people thought were their useful life, just because they were there. And so the argument is you just got to stop building these things. You know, other people point to the short-term jobs impact and for these specific workers and say, look, we need to take a more gradual approach to this. I think overall, there have been far more jobs in the clean energy economy than the traditional economy in terms of job growth in the past several years. And in 2019, the fastest growing job category in the United States were solar panel installers. I haven't seen the data for 2020, but there was some slowdown in 2020 because of COVID. But even despite that, there's been some pretty significant growth in solar. I think this is going to be central to what the Biden administration is trying to do, is figure out how do you build on this incredible growth in the clean energy economy? How do you create jobs? And by the way, the Secretary of Energy appointee, Jennifer Granholm's former governor of Michigan, has been deeply involved in this issue for many, many years. So she's taken on as a cause creating jobs in the clean energy economy. So I know she and others are going to be very, very focused on that.
One of the things that I know is important to the Biden administration, and especially here in Utah, is the issue of fuel production on public lands. And the previous administration greatly reduced areas formerly protected in the Bears Ears Monument here in Utah. What do you expect to happen with respect to these areas, and should we expect prolonged litigation?
I think we're going to see a much stronger support for conservation ethic for, you know, Bears Ear and a bit all over in federal lands. This being the United States of America, yes, I would expect litigation as part of this. It's often the way that we resolve issues. But I think, you know, one of one of the striking and interesting, you know, appointments in the from President Biden has been his appointee for Secretary of the Interior, Congresswoman Deb Haaland, who's the first Native American ever to be appointed to that role, and it's a dramatic appointment. And I think these issues are going to be very controversial in some parts of the West and around the country.
I want to talk a little bit about vehicles, because I know that's something that's always been a great interest of yours. What do you think we will see in terms of government action with respect to both a traditional fossil fuel-powered vehicles and things like fuel standards, and with respect to electric vehicles?
And by what I want to add to our listeners who might know Roger, I've learned a lot on vehicles from Roger. Roger knows a lot about this topic as well. I think we're going to see a very determined effort to promote a transition in the vehicle fleet. And there was a wonderful campaign ad for those of us who pay attention to electric vehicles that President Biden had, in which he climbed in, I think it was a Camaro, but it was a sports car, talked about how he loved this car and how he's looking forward to the electric version. And there's a lot that the government can do in this regard. One of the big pieces is promoting electric vehicle charging infrastructure. And in the campaign, President Biden pledged to support the construction of 500,000 electric vehicle chargers around the country. There's been some federal support for electric vehicles. I expect that to continue and to maybe look at ways to make that more effective. And then I think battery cost is probably the principal or one of the principal barriers to deployment of electric vehicles. I think we'll see more research and development in bringing down the cost of electric vehicle batteries. Although I have to say that the price curves here are getting, I mean, it's getting very close. I mean, historically, purchasing an electric vehicle has been several thousand dollars more expensive than a comparable conventional vehicle, you know, with a gasoline tank. But if you look at the cost curves for batteries, within a couple of years, that is probably not going to be true. I think it is at least possible that we're really reaching an inflection point where the upfront purchase price of electric vehicles be the same as comparable car. By the way, already, depending on how you use the car, already the lifetime cost of an electric vehicle and counting, you know, is probably less than the lifetime cost of an equivalent conventional vehicle, because it's cheaper to recharge your vehicle with electricity than it is to fill it up with gasoline. But people don't buy vehicles, you know, they don't do it on that basis. They don't look at a lifetime cost, and, you know, they basically purchase based upon the upfront cost. But I think that cost curve could be changing soon.
And I hesitate to correct.
One other thing on that. It's amazing how many new models are coming out. There's going to be an electric F-150, which Ford has announced, coming out in a couple of years. You know, most popular vehicle in the United States today, pickup truck that you know, can get amazing performance with an electric vehicle. You know, electric vehicles have instant torque, so you can really get some power out of electric vehicles. So I think the 2020s could be a decade of major transformation when it comes to the vehicle fleet.
And I hesitate to correct our expert, but in fact, John Kerry was getting in. I'm sorry. In fact, President Biden was getting into a Corvette. I also can't help but note that David was probably the first person I ever heard of to get a custom plug-in Prius. I believe you were I believe you had a custom plug-in hybrid Prius years ago.
That's a good memory. Yep, that's exactly right.
And I also believe that the new Hummer electric vehicle that GM is going to come out with, the statistics on its acceleration are just phenomenal. So I agree that's a very exciting area. Allison?
So want to go back to kind of the clean energy area. What steps would you expect the administration to take with respect to promoting wind, solar, and other renewables?
That's such an important question. And just as background, it's amazing how much the price of those technologies have come down in recent years. The cost of a solar panel have dropped about 90% in the past decade, and the cost of wind turbines have dropped by at a roughly two-thirds. And that's one reason we're seeing such amazing, you know, job growth in this area. And incredible growth in the deployment of these technologies. I think the Biden administration, I think you'll see a support for additional tech for tax credit, extension of tax credits in this area, which happened. There's an extension in December, but I think you'll see support for more in this area. I think you'll see a lot of work on energy storage, which is a critical complement to solar and wind power. I mean, the solar and wind power right now is very cheap, but there is a problem, which is that the sun doesn't always shine and the wind doesn't always blow. And so in order for solar and wind power to effectively provide constant power, need a range of tools. One of them is one possible approach is energy storage, like batteries. And I think we'll see, as I said, with respect to vehicles, we'll see work on bringing down the cost of that. We'll also see work on just kind of the technical aspects of integrating storage into electric grids. But another tool are transmission lines, because if you have transmission lines, you can move solar power, for example, from a place where the sun is shining to a place where the sun isn't shining. Solar transmission lines can be very difficult to site in the United States. We have a complex regulatory patchwork that prevents that in many instances. I think you'll see work by the Biden administration to try to facilitate the construction of electric transmission lines for solar and wind power.
You know, here in Park City, for example, we certainly see the sprouting of solar panels on roofs all over town. And so that's a very, very sort of decentralized approach to energy production. Will we see something like that with respect to wind? Are you going to see personalized windmills? You know, is that a technology that has some vibrance?
I think much less, Roger. It's a really good question. I expect to see much. I think you'll see some of that, maybe not that much on people's homes, but, you know, maybe in smaller, you know, like commercial settings. But the best wind power is achieved by getting big turbines that are way, way up high. And there are these massive ones that have now been built due to innovations in materials technologies and other things that make it possible to scale these very high. So I think that there could be more growth in that area. One particularly interesting area in wind is offshore wind. I guess it's not directly relevant in Utah, but that's been a technology that historically has been considered to be too expensive to deploy in scale. The ocean is a very challenging environment to operate any type of equipment. The salt water is corrosive. It's very difficult to get out and repair equipment due to weather challenges in the marine environment. But due to some improvements, again, in material sciences and other types of technologies, the cost of this offshore wind has come down dramatically. And we've seen the first major development in the United States. A huge project was just being launched off the coast of Long Island. And in Europe and in Asia, we're seeing growth in this technology as well. And there's just extraordinary wind off the coast. So in places like China, where you have some of the densest population in the world right along the seashore, if offshore wind can take off, it could really make a difference in terms of promoting clean energy.
David, I'd like to thank you for sharing your insights today. We've been fortunate this morning to be joined by David Sandilow, former Acting Undersecretary of Energy and Assistant Secretary for Policy and International Affairs. He's currently the inaugural fellow at the Center on Global Energy Policy and co-director of the Energy and Environment Concentration at Columbia University. Thank you for joining us.
It's been great talking with you. Thank you.
Thanks, David.
Mountain Money will be right back after this.
Our next guest is Fawn Germer, the author of Coming Back, How to Win the Job You Want When You've Lost the Job You Need. Fawn Germer is one of America's most sought-after keynote speakers on leadership. She is a four-time Pulitzer Prize-nominated investigative journalist. She's the best-selling author of 9 books, including the Oprah pick, Hard Won Wisdom. Coming Back is a book that shows you how you can save a career if still employed, or get one back if cast out. The book is a tactical, tough love call to action to learn, retool, connect, grow, and get back to work, to get ready to go back to work. Thank you for joining us, Ms. Germer. Welcome to Mountain Money.
Well, hey, that's great to be here on a Monday.
And it is a beautiful Monday here in Park City, and we appreciate your time. Okay.
And it's a gorgeous one down here in Dunedin, Florida.
Excellent. So looking for a job these days feels kind of daunting. It feels, and it's probably true, that people are competing against millions of unemployed people who all want the same job. Should our listeners feel defeated?
Well, it depends what they're going to do. If they are going to do what everybody else is going to do, yeah, might as well throw in the towel because it doesn't look real good. But there is a lot you can do to boost your chances of getting hired. And the first thing being, leverage your network. Now, we've all heard that forever, but the thing we haven't heard is how we're not doing it the right way and how to expand our network. So first thing you do is figure out 10 companies you want to work at. That's your bucket list. And then on LinkedIn, go there and look for leaders in that company that you can connect with. So you add them in and then kind of stalk them for several weeks to see if they're sharing articles and posts that you can then comment on. And then the more you do that, eventually, then you send the email within LinkedIn that says, you know, I've been following some of these posts. I'm interested in your company and I'm not sure how to break through. Can we do a 15-minute Zoom and coffee? And some people will say no, but it's funny how many will say yes. And I've always found that when somebody says no, there's always someone else, either at the same company or somewhere else, that will say yes. Because applying online in many cases is like sending your application into a dark black hole. But if you can get someone to carry you in there, then you've got gold. And the other thing, if I don't ramble on too long, is when you have a network, you have to know how to use it so that you ask specifically for what you need. And you say, I need a personal favor. Will you please connect with so-and-so in such department and give that person my resume? And then can you do an email introduction for us? Because then you're making it past the algorithm that unfortunately discriminates against a lot of people for a lot of reasons. And even though it seems like you may have a fair chance, you don't.
One of the things that I found interesting in the book was, particularly for someone who's older and applying for a job, is the importance of being able to look forward rather than relying on looking back. Can you talk a little bit about that concept?
Yeah, and it's really frustrating because we worked so hard to get so much experience and we're proud of our accomplishments and achievements and deserve respect at this point in our careers, because isn't that what our parents got? You know, they worked really hard, they advanced, people were nice, they got to rest on their laurels a little bit, but we are in a climate that doesn't care about your experience. I'm really sorry to be blunt, but shut up about it until you can show that you have done all the work it takes to drive into the future. And that doesn't mean you're just keeping up with technology. If you've got one of the higher paychecks where you work, you have to know technology and where it's going so that you can have a conversation to say, this is what we need to do in the future. And when you brand yourself as relevant and current, then your experience does matter because it shows you've been there all along and have done it. But if all you can say is, well, 20 years ago at IBM, we did X, Y, and Z, nobody cares. And you have to remember, if you've been somewhere a long time or are advanced in your career, you likely have one of the higher salaries. But you've got millennials and then Gen Zers who can do more in half the time for half the money because they're so technologically agile. So you have to be able to use technology and innovate with it. You don't have to be a programmer, but you don't want to be someone who doesn't know how to use what's coming to create greater success for your company.
And I think one of the ways you describe that is really upskill. Read, watch, and talk. And there's also lots of opportunities for additional coursework.
Absolutely. There's so much online learning. And really the best online learning is free. Because if you go to a place like Coursera.org, that's C-O-U-R-S-E-R-A.org, or edX, edX.org, these places have classes at Ivy League schools, at all the big schools and great schools, and in current topics. So you're learning from professors at Harvard or Yale on what is going to be driving the future, getting the latest, greatest stuff. And the first time I did it, I took a class in innovation from MIT, and I hope you are very impressed by that. But, you know, it's not a big deal. That's the thing. You sound current just because you did these things. And so I took this class and just went back into school mode so that I could succeed at it, and I started getting ready for the first test, and I realized I don't need the degree. I don't need a grade. I need the information. And the pressure's off, because all you need is the current knowledge. You don't have to get an A in the class. Just get the information. And so take classes in artificial intelligence and robotics and all of these technologies, big data, machine learning, blockchain, that are these things that are going to drive your industry. And before you figure out what to take, just do a search, trends in the fill-in-the-blank industry. So if you are at trends in the radio industry, and then see what's coming ahead for your industry, from your profession, and your specific job, and then train yourself. Don't wait for someone else to say, you need to know this. You need to know it before they say it, so that you can help them drive the conversation forward.
So I know that, well, this is one of my, I think, four-letter words in my world, networking. But you stated that COVID-19 is a gift to power networking for those who dare. And networking is just, for me, daunting, and it's like a hurdle I don't want to go over.
I get that, because people see me, and I'm a motivational speaker on stage, and I have thousands of people, but put me in a cocktail party where I don't know anybody, and I'm a mess. So in my book, Coming Back, I've got a lot of pickup lines for networking, and that's when we're out and about, and this is COVID time. So how do you network in COVID?
Yeah.
It's a lot easier. Who knew? So, and I noticed this early on in the lockdown. I have, because of what I do as a leadership speaker, I know a lot of very influential people. And I befriended them in my network. And somebody says, well, why do they want to be friends with you? And I was like, I don't know. Maybe they don't have any friends. But when COVID came around, I sent an email out to 15 people that are real superheroes in business. Very hard to get people. They're very well-known leaders. And I said, we'll be doing a group Zoom call Tuesday at 6 p.m. I didn't even ask them when it would be convenient, because I knew everybody was on lockdown. So I thought I'd get four or five. I had sent it to 15 people, showed up on Tuesday, and 15 of them were there. The odds of getting people with schedules like that were zero on a normal time, because they're never available. And I just said, let's do wine at 6 o'clock Tuesday. And everybody showed up and then kept showing up, and still, because people are still home doing nothing. So you use your network that way with your friends, and if you want to grow your network, bring your mentor in one time to do a session with some people, and then have everybody bring their mentors, and then get the mentors to bring the mentors, and then the power level continues to rise. But people are looking for intriguing, stimulating conversation that they're not getting because they're not doing as much as they used to do. And so this is a great time to do it. We've got the technology that makes that possible. And, you know, you've got my sympathies with hating talking to strangers, because that's not my thing either. But that's where opportunity lies. It all lies in having friendships in the right places. And I don't mean business connections, friendships. So that if you're going to network with me, you can say, oh, Vaughn Germer, former journalist, author 9 books, big speaker. No. To be in my network, you need to know Vaughn Germer, avid cyclist, passionate kayaker, loves her pit bull dog, lives in Florida. I mean, it's these things that connect to somebody personally that then create a relationship. And then as you have the relationship, then you call in the chits very specifically and say what you need and when.
So let's say that I've done a good job at cultivating a relationship, and that allows me to ask somebody to look at my resume seriously. So I've gotten myself into the door and I've gotten myself to the first stage. In this environment, I don't get to get on an airplane and go visit them and get an interview. So how do I move, you know, how do I best and most effectively get past that first interview, even if it's got to be on an online basis?
Well, the best thing about online interviews is that so many people are bad at them. And right, I mean, you just got to look at it as it's bad television, right? It's people see everything in your screen. So don't have clutter behind you. Get a decent light. And seriously, you can't look dark. So make yourself look good. Put your makeup on. Get and give yourself a makeover. You cannot look frumpy or sloppy. And I'm telling you, it's time for tough love. Look in the mirror. Be honest. Do I look a little sloppy and frumpy? Okay, I'm going to figure out something that looks really great, that I feel great in. And whether you've gained weight in COVID or some other time, I don't care. You can be overweight and look great in an online interview. But you want to have the visual be crisp and perfect before anything even comes out of your mouth. And then figure exactly where the camera is, and that's where you look. You don't look at where the person is on your screen. You're making eye contact with the camera, and you're talking directly to a human being from your heart.
I know those are great tips for online interviews. Do you have any others you could share with us about that?
About online interviews?
Yeah.
Well, you don't ramble on. You know what you're going to say. Know when to stop talking. Be ready with questions you can ask back. The beauty of an online interview is you can have talking points all around you, and they won't even know that, so that you have things that you want to stress. And again, don't go overboard about the experience. You have to say it, but particularly if you're middle-aged, that can be something that works against you. If you say, oh, I've got 30 years in my profession, you want to say what you're doing and when, and then in these conversations, show that you're engaged and a team player, and you never say, oh, my son's as old as you are, or even worse, I have a grandchild your age. No, right? And look, by now, millennials are in leadership, and they can tell if you've got that attitude toward a millennial, and it's about time we started respecting them. They had different work habits, and they got a big Bronx cheer when they got to the workplace because they didn't follow the rules, but they did something. They delivered. So now many of them are doing the interviews, and when they're talking to someone older, you can't make it look like you're talking down to them in the slightest or that you know more than them. You have to convey you are a team player, that you want to learn from them as well. So in this conversation, you're not talking to someone your kid's age. You're talking to your equal, and you're making it very clear that you're there to add value to what they are working on and that you're very excited by the opportunity.
In your book, you did mention, and this is related to kind of not disclosing your age, but eliminating the time frames on your resume. You talk about that. And in some ways, it's so hard to do because there's that experience that you've kind of built everything upon.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's what we're told to do. And I hear it again and again, don't use anything beyond 10 years. Well, if we don't go beyond 10 years on my resume, nobody knows that I had an Oprah book or that I was an investigative reporter or any of that. And I think that's very important, but now it's only important as an aside. What we accentuate is what we're doing now and what we're going to do. So you just have to really hit hard on the classes you've taken to show that you are still seeking knowledge, you're insatiably curious, and that you won't stop because you want to deliver.
One of the things that we've made reference to in our conversation so far is LinkedIn. And how important is a LinkedIn profile, and what is it that you should be thinking about if you're looking for a job with respect to how that profile is set up?
Well, there are many, many resources online showing you how to have the perfect LinkedIn profile. And first thing you do is study them, the different ones, because they all have different suggestions that will get you where you need to go. You don't want it to be a list of titles, particularly your headline is your advertisement. So you don't want it to just say your title. You want it to convey that you are just this badass innovator or whatever, so that they are in the game. So your titles matter, and the things that you post matter, and your attitude matters with it. So it's not just a boring list, but there's so much out there and what you can do with that, and really study that so that you decide what works best for you.
That's great. And I think that makes tons of sense. The book, the book is Coming Back, How to Win the Job You Want When You've Lost the Job You Need. And we've been talking with Fawn Germer. Fawn, thank you for this great conversation.
Thank you so much. Good luck, everybody.
Thank you. Mountain Money will be right back after this. Welcome back to Mountain Money. Chop Shop Park City is Park City's first full-service butcher shop, serving the highest quality cuts of beef, pork, lamb, and poultry. Chop Shop is focused on providing customers with responsibly sourced products from their local purveyors. This morning, we are joined by John Courtney, Chop Shop's butcher and co-owner. John, thanks for joining us.
Hi, good morning.
So tell us a little bit about Chop Shop Park City. What is it that you have to offer, and how is this a new, unique business to our community?
So our tagline is butchered, cured, and wood-fired. So at Chop Shop Park City, we offer local as well as sustainably sourced and harvested meats. When we can find it local, we can. If not, we'll go out and source the best of those items. For example, prosciutto to Parma, you're going to go to Parma for that. Not that there aren't great curators of cured meats in this state, but if we can't find a local producer, we'll go out to find them. From a wood-fired perspective, we have a small hot food menu that we want to showcase some of the items out of the meat case or the cheese and charcuterie case and what you could kind of do with it with a sandwich at home or a breakfast sandwich. Like, we have our breakfast all day. It's our house buttermilk biscuit, our house breakfast sausage, right out of a wood-fired oven. And then cured. So cured is our cheese and charcuterie section. We curate boards for you that you can take home and have for your events, or you can DIY it and purchase different cuts of cured meats and cheeses and take them home yourself and kind of curate your own cheese and charcuterie board.
Talk a little bit about how the kinds of meat products that I would find at your shop are different than what I would get if I just went into the grocery store.
So because we harvest full animal too, so for example, lamb comes from the center of the state, Three Shepherds lamb. They're in Elsinore, Utah, right by Richfield area. And so because of some of my background in Europe and butchery practices there, we have different cuts that you wouldn't normally see in a traditional meat shop. For example, the saddle and the tenderloin on a lamb. I have yet to see one anywhere outside of Europe, to be honest, or at least not on a French menu in a restaurant. Saddle is a great part. It's a boneless area that we take off, so similar in flavor to a lamb chop with a little less fat and a little more meat. So that's something that's unique you would see in our shop that you wouldn't necessarily find at a traditional butcher shop or meat market.
So I have to ask you, if the saddles don't show up in the grocery store, where do they go?
You know, it's a good point, because it's a large portion. Even the tenderloin, like, when have you seen a lamb tender, you know, or a lamb filet, if you will? I would imagine a lot of it goes into processing for sausage, which to me doesn't make a lot of sense.
So it seems like kind of a waste. How did the idea for Chop Shop Park City come about? What inspired you to do this?
So I have two business partners as well. To kind of three of us that came together as friends and business partners, and they had seen a similar style shop in California with a little bit more focus on cured product. So I've seen, you know, the Eataly's of the world and different formats that seem to work where you have raw items that you could take or retail items that you can take home and cook yourself, as well as a small eat-in counter. It's very common in Europe as well. So I wanted to kind of share that with the area.
One thing, you know, when you mentioned the different types of meat cuts, I don't know how to cook them. So is that something that, you know, if someone's coming in and they want to try something new, that they could talk to you or someone else there and you can kind of walk through maybe the best preparation style?
Yeah, that's been really exciting for me, kind of coming out of the kitchen and being more in the forefront with the guest. So I handwrite a recipe for you on the spot. For example, the lamb saddle, since we've been talking about it, We had some guests come in recently that had never cooked something of that nature. So I wrote out a recipe for them. They came back in a couple of days later, which was great to see a repeat guest. And they loved the preparation. So I try to keep it simple. People are coming and buy really large, grandiose steaks these days too, you know, large tomahawks and such. And when you have a 3-inch thick, you know, almost 3-pound steak, how do you cook that without burning the outside and leaving the inside raw? So I try to give techniques and ideas like reverse sear, something that someone can follow and do without any kind of real training and still accomplish the same task of getting their meat cooked the way they would like it.
And are you going to be posting some of those recipes on your website so that your customers who don't have the advantage of seeing the handwritten one can get access to them?
Yeah, we're, you know, kind of slow in getting that process done, and I blame myself on that part. I do like the personal service and being able to speak to someone right there and take the time with them to kind of work through the recipe. I feel as if I just posted something or just handed you a printed card, it's less personal.
Sure.
But it is a modern world, and having access to things readily available is a little bit easier, especially if someone were to lose that recipe that I hand wrote. So it would make sense for us to get that on our website sooner.
I know there's a lot to do when you're starting out a business, and so that's completely understandable that that may not have been a top priority. But you've talked a bit about, you know, Europe and how they're doing things and you being a chef, but your journey is a bit atypical in that you started as a banker. Tell us that story.
Yeah, so during high school, I had the opportunity to become a bank teller. I really enjoyed the work. You know, banking is as such that it's not really what they have to offer as much as it is the, you know, services and the benefits of those offers. And I kind of enjoyed that sales aspect. So I continued to do well with Wells Fargo Bank and moved up through there, became a branch manager at the age of 20 years old. And moved to Las Vegas and wasn't able to gamble, was a manager of 30 employees that ranged from 18 to 55 years old. So it was a a little bit of a daunting task at that age. I don't know that I was as good of a manager then, obviously, because I was so young as I am now, but I learned a lot from those banking years, and having that finance background really is beneficial with running a restaurant. We have such tight margins, especially these days, even more so. So it's been really helpful for me.
I want to go back and talk a little bit about what the range of cured meats that you have are. What are cured meats, and where do you get them from?
So we source through a purveyor in the state, Opiori, for quite a few of those. Cured meats can be air cured. They can be cured by nitrate or a chemical process, if you will. Salt is another way. Thyme is a way. So our cured meats range from Bresaola from Pennsylvania to Prosciutto di Parma, which is aged in air in caves for several years before it comes out. And that's just packed with salt. And actually fat is a way they preserve the outside of the meat so that no bad bacteria have time to flourish. we also have some from Birmingham, Alabama. American Butcher were the first ones to carry it in the state of Utah. His name is Mike Sullivan. They deem him the Reverend of Fat, but he's a seam butcher. And so you'll find in his salumis, you'll never find any kind of sinew or anything, because his butcher shop breaks down an animal in such a way that nothing is left. So when they process it, it's just pure meat and good fats.
One of the things that you mentioned that you have are cheeses. So are those locally sourced as well?
Yes. So Gold Creek Farms, we have several of their cheeses, and they make our cheese for our Detroit-style pizza that we do. So they make our mozzarella to a very specific hydration and to a very specific salt level for us. We also carry their hoppy cheddar, which is a really great cheddar. They found wild hops on their farm and harvested them and wrapped them around this four-year-aged cheddar that they do out there.
One of the things you see when you go into a fancy steakhouse is on the menu, they'll say something about how it's been aged. What does that mean? And is that something that you do as well?
We do. I'm glad you asked. So we have a dry aging program as well. our dry aging program starts at 28 days and goes up from there. Dry aging is a process of removing water, essentially, from meat, as well as if you get into the science of it, the yeast that creates a crust on the outside to protect the meat talks to the enzymes on the inside. And it really gives it a story about the flora and fauna that's in that case. So that's built based on airflow, temperature, and humidity. We keep ours below 38 degrees, so really, really cold, not freezing, and high humidity, so that we're not removing a ton of water, but still adding that flora and fauna taste, that hazelnut, that blue cheese flavor that most people attribute to dry-aged meats.
And from my recollection, you actually have a pretty kind of narrow square footage. You're only at like 1,700 feet. Is everything done on site?
It is. Majority. We have baker. Our baker is off-site, which is we use Hawk and Sparrow out of Midway. Andrew does an amazing job. Some of the best bread I've tasted in Utah. There's some other great, great bakers out there, but we were lucky enough to be able to work with him. He makes our sandwich bread. And then we have an off-site commissary where we're able to make our pizza doughs and our buttermilk biscuits in-house.
Before we go, we need to make sure that we let our audience know how to find you, both in person and online.
ChopShopParkCity.com, as well as our Instagram and Facebook page. And then we're at 1177 Center Drive in Park City, Utah. Right sandwiched between Hearth and Hill and Best Buy.
And days of the week you're open?
We're closed on Mondays, Tuesday through Sunday, 10 to 6, and Sunday at 11 to 4.
That's perfect. Well, we've been speaking with John Courtney. He is the owner and butcher of Chop Shop Park City, located in New Park. Thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much for having us. Really appreciate sharing our new adventure.
Absolutely. Well, Mountain Money will be right back after this. You've been listening to Mountain Money, broadcast on KPCW, Park City, Utah. For more information, please visit kpcw.org. Please take a moment and give us a rating on your podcast app.